very interesting to find out how many people who are today in the software industry, including founding members of Infosys, including people who played a very key role in the Tata Consultancy Services when they started their computer initiatives. Many of these key people came and spent time in TIFR working, using the computers and so on, and have very fond memories of that and were influenced by that experience. So that is a tribute, again, in a sense, to Professor Narasimhan and the team and the department he helped build up over time. So it's a real privilege for me to be here, and I'm sure for all of us to be here and to hear this talk, which will be given by Professor Ganapathy. As Vinod just reminded me, he was actually here as a VSRP student in 2000 and actually sat through without walking out on a talk on string theory that I gave. In those times, it was a very good tradition. Somehow we were talking again with Professor Shamsundar. This is again something which we don't do anymore. In those times, and it was true in my times, I was also a VSRP even further back. The VSRP students had to hear the talks from all areas. You know, you may be a VSRP student in computer science, but you had to hear a talk in string theory, had to, and vice versa, and I think that was a good thing. We don't do that anymore, but anyway, so it's very nice to welcome Vinod back also onto campus. And well, with those few words, I invite Professor Shamsundar to introduce our speaker this afternoon.
Thank you. So it's a pleasure to ask, when I was asked to introduce, because I retired, and so I asked Raju to find from STCS. It so happens all the people from STCS, it seems they are in the FSTTCS, which TIFR initiated in the 1981. So for that reason, I was to come for the talk, but I am introduced a kind of a framework. So I think it is a pleasure to have Professor Sandeep Trivedi, Director, finding time to be here. And also I see Mustan Sir Verma, who was there when this endowment was initiated. And I welcome particularly Krishna Bharat. I guess he will be on the webcast from the California time in odd time. So I think if he is there, welcome to him, kind of a framework or the other. As you know, this is already Professor Trivedi told that it is Narasimhan is essentially treated as a Bhishma Pitamaha for the computer science for his various contributions, including in the academic contributions, was on the syntactic pattern recognition, for which he is very well known, kind of a framework or the other. And so it's a pleasure to have Professor Ganapathy for this memorial lecture. And one of the conditions for this is he has to be under 40, and then he has to be an invited speaker for a conference being held in India, and he should have done at least one of the university courses in India. So matching all these three has not been a very easy thing in the past 3 years for which I have been a member, kind of a framework. Nevertheless, I think we have had very distinguished members giving this one, Professor Sanjit Sheshia from UC Berkeley, the first one, the second one by Kaushik Sen, again from UC Berkeley, and now Professor Ganapathy. And it so happens the first one also was a VSRP, and Professor Ganapathy has also been a VSRP, and I'm happy to learn that he is still in, as an outsider, interested in the string theory when he saw you. So I was really, this is a reminder that we need to give something more to the students of the this generation. So he is currently an associate professor of computer science at Rutgers, and he received his PhD from Wisconsin from Professor Somesh Jha, who is a distinguished professor working on security, kind of a framework. It so happened Professor Somesh Jha was a master student when I was in Penn State, so in some sense there is a good connection, kind of a framework. And Ganapathy graduated from IIT Bombay, and then He has won several awards in the National NSF Career 2010 Award, also Rutgers University Board of Trustees Fellowship, and also Best Paper Outstanding Student Paper Awards at Computer Science Security Application Conference. Without much ado, I request Professor Ganapathy to give.
So thank you very much. You know, I'd like to thank the Institute for inviting me. It's really a pleasure and honor to give this lecture and to be back at TIFR after 15 years. VSRP was really my initiation into computer science research. So I'm really thankful to the Institute for setting me on that path. So my talk today is on self-service cloud computing, which is a cloud security project that my students and I have worked on for the past nearly 5 years. But before I delve into the technical details, let me briefly introduce the kind of work that I do. My work is primarily focused on the design and implementation of secure computer systems, and I draw inspiration from the software engineering literature in addressing problems in computer security. So, broadly speaking, the problems that I'm looking at right now are in cloud platform security at the very large end of the computing spectrum, and I'm also looking at security issues at the very small end of the computing spectrum, little tiny devices, the Internet of Things, and all of these things. And you know, the connecting tissue in between is the web browser and web applications, and I've also been looking at issues there. So this slide just lays out a few of the kinds of questions that my students and I like to investigate, we like to ask, and we like to probe in these systems. So my talk today is on the first area, cloud platform security. And so let me sort of begin by addressing the elephant in the room, which is, what is the cloud, right? I asked myself this question when we were initially beginning work in cloud computing security. And depending on who I asked what the cloud was, I got different answers. And so I think that the elephant in the room analogy is appropriate. Trying to describe the cloud is almost like this story of the six blind men and the elephant, right? So depending on who you ask, you're going to get a different answer. You know, we have all used email services. We use web services for shopping. We have all, you know, logged into server computers for our computing needs. So, you know, why is it that this cloud became a buzzword probably in the late 2000s? What changed, and what is the cloud, right? So let me define what I mean by cloud platforms before addressing what security issues can arise in these platforms. So by cloud, I mean that, you know, we are talking about a distributed computing platform that's managed by third parties. This is important. You don't own your computing environment. Somebody else is managing the computing environment for you, and you're entrusting your code and data with this third-party provider, and you're going to run all of your computations on this third-party provider. So it comes in many flavors, but they're characterized by ending with the AAS acronym, right? So it's as a service. You can have infrastructure as a service, platform as a service, database as a storage, storage as a service, and so on. I won't get into the details of what each one of these terms means. Frankly, they're not even clear to me. But the main reason why the cloud has become so popular is that there are a lot of economic benefits to be had by migrating your computations to the cloud. A third party is managing all of your computing needs, so you don't have to acquire computing resources, you don't have to maintain them, somebody else is maintaining them for you. So as a result of all of this, there were predictions a couple of years ago that nearly 90% of all government agencies would have migrated to the cloud. I don't know what the number is. That's one of the nice things about predictions. You can now go and check if there is a nice way to go and find these numbers. But there are many new services, for example, Instagram and the online education platform edX. They all exclusively rely on their cloud for their on the cloud for their computing needs. And I'm going to distinguish in this talk between public and private cloud platforms. So when I say a public cloud platform, I mean something like Amazon's EC2 service or Microsoft's Azure service, where a third-party provider is providing their computing environment to outsiders to come and run their computations on. This is as opposed to private cloud infrastructures, which typically are what things like banks and financial houses rely on, because they want to safeguard their data within their data centers. They don't want to let it out to other third parties. And this sort of leads into my talk. What are the security issues? Why are banks and financial houses and all of these entities that manage sensitive data, why are they so hesitant to send their data out into these public cloud infrastructures? What are the threats and what can we do about them? That's the subject of my talk. All right. So I'm going to begin by sort of defining what modern cloud computing looks like. And, you know, so I'm going to use all of these buzzwords. I'll define them to the best of my ability. But if there are any questions, please feel free to ask. Okay, so I'm going to use the word cloud. I'm going to use the word platform. And I'm going to try to define all of these things. All right. So a cloud is nothing but a huge collection of machines sitting somewhere in a data center that's managed by one of these entities, Amazon, Microsoft, what have you. Each one of the computing nodes that sits in this data center looks like this. So you have the computing hardware, which is your motherboard, your networking card, and so on. And on top of this, you have a software layer called the hypervisor. It's also called a virtual machine monitor. This runs on top of the bare hardware. And on top of this, we have clients who run their computations within virtual machines. You can rent some computation time on Amazon, and what you get is basically a virtual machine, which I'm going to abbreviate VM. And so each one of these icons, these worker icons that you see on the right of the slide, are basically clients who are renting computation on the cloud. So together with these client virtual machines, there is also a management virtual machine. This is something that's managed by the cloud provider. And this is necessary in order to maintain the machine. You need to be able to run maintenance software. You need to be able to figure out which virtual machines have hung, kill them. You need to be able to allocate resources for these virtual machines. And all of that happens within this virtual machine, this management virtual machine, which I will refer to using this term called DOM 0 for technical reasons. That's just how it's been referred to in the literature. And this icon right here, this policeman icon, shows you basically who's in control. The cloud provider controls the hypervisor, it controls the management virtual machine, and it uses its administrators, its employees, to go and manage the cloud. Each one of these nodes is controlled by the management virtual machine. So the problems that sort of arise in a cloud computing setting, in a public cloud computing setting, is that, let's say that you're a client and you want to use the cloud, you go and approach a cloud provider saying, I want this much computation, this much, this many CPU cycles, this much memory, and so on. The cloud provider is implicitly expecting the clients to entrust them with their code and data. But the client is also trusting the day-to-day cloud administrators, the people who maintain the cloud. These are humans who actually sit in and configure machines on the cloud. The client is also implicitly trusting these cloud administrators who are basically employees of this provider. All right. So that's the problem, because these cloud administrators have access to anything that runs on these machines. They can go and poke at the data. They can see all of the client's data. And so this puts the client's code and data, the secrecy and integrity of this code and data, at risk. The cloud administrators can view them and perhaps sell them off for money. Okay, so this is a big risk. This is why you find that enterprises that store sensitive data don't go and run their offerings on public cloud enterprises. So that's one big problem. And this is not a made up problem. There have been instances of data breaches on the cloud. There was an instance a few years ago where an employee of Microsoft was caught spying on somebody's Hotmail account. There was a Google employee who was caught spying on children's data. And of course, the famous NSA Snowden leaks are an instance where an employee, in this case, went and probed into data that he should not have otherwise been accessing. So this is why you find that, as I said, enterprises like banks and finance companies don't go to public clouds, right? So they're afraid that somebody might steal their data. So the other big problem is that when you go to a public cloud infrastructure, you're relying on the cloud provider to provide services for you. Over the last 15 years, we have seen a lot of work in this virtual machine technology that has enabled a number of novel technologies. For example, you can detect very advanced form of malicious software these days using virtual machine technology. Malicious software often goes by the name malware, and that's what I've used here. You can checkpoint your virtual machines. You can use encrypted storage. You have access to a wide variety of services that are made possible because of virtualization. But the problem is when you go to a cloud provider, the cloud provider controls the virtual machine platform, and so you're relying on this provider to provide all of these services for you. You as an end client, even though you're running on top of a virtual machine platform, don't have the freedom to deploy these services on your own. So if the cloud provider just says that he has a subset of the services that you want, that's what you're stuck with. You can't really do advanced things on the cloud. All right. So why do these problems arise? It's because the cloud provider is really powerful and the clients are basically wimpy, okay, as this cartoon shows. So I illustrate this with an example, okay? So let's take the example of malicious software detection. If you have a virtual machine, as I mentioned, you can detect very advanced form of malicious software. So how would you do something like this using virtual machine technology? Essentially, you would run your checker, the thing that's going to look for malicious software, within the management VM, which is all powerful. It has access to each one of the client virtual machines. The management VM goes and fetches code and data pages from client virtual machines that are running on the same host in the cloud. It processes these pages. For example, it looks for signatures and so on, just like your antivirus might do. It checks it against a security policy, and it determines whether the client VM is infected or not. If it's not infected, everything is okay. If it's infected, well, then it can raise an alert and stop the computation. Now, on the cloud, the management VM is owned by the cloud provider. So is the hypervisor. So that brings us to the first problem I mentioned. The client actually relies on the cloud provider to deploy this checking daemon, the security service, on its behalf. If it wants a custom checking service, it has absolutely no ability to do so on today's cloud computing environments. And this also brings into focus the other problem, which is that if you have a malicious cloud administrator who has complete access to the management virtual machine, he can go and peek into all of the data. He can look at all of the contents of the code and the data pages that are executing in the client virtual machine. And this is an unacceptable breach of the client's privacy. And the cloud administrator does not have to be malicious. It so turns out that this management virtual machine on most deployed cloud platforms, it's a full-fledged Linux stack or a Windows stack that runs advanced checking daemons. So it may exceed in easily on the order of a million lines of code or even more. And so not surprisingly, there have been a history of vulnerabilities that have been reported in this management virtual machine, DOM 0 and hypervisors, that allow even otherwise, you know, even if you have benign cloud administrators, remote attackers can go and take over this management virtual machine and compromise client virtual machine privacy and data, privacy and integrity. So these are sort of the problems that motivate the need for a more secure cloud platform, and that's what I will describe in this talk, this infrastructure called self-service cloud computing. And the basic idea is going to be that we're going to try to make the management virtual machine wimpy and the client virtual machines more powerful. Now, this is not an easy problem. You can't just take power away from the management virtual machine and give it to the clients, because then, you know, you have to do this in a nuanced way, because otherwise the cloud provider loses all of the power over his own cloud, over his own platform, and that's not something that cloud providers are willing to do. Okay, so you have to do this in a nuanced way. So let's see how. All right. So since this is a security talk, one of the first things that I must do when I define my security problem is to define the threat model, which means to say, who is the attacker, what is the attacker capable of? So I'm going to distinguish between cloud providers and cloud administrators for the purpose of this talk. So a cloud provider is going to be an entity such as Microsoft or Google or Amazon that has a vested interest in protecting its reputation. Okay, so it wants to protect its reputation. It's not going to do anything bad on purpose. On the other hand, you know, in order to accomplish its day-to-day computing needs, it has to employ administrators. These are humans who run scripts, who maintain the cloud on behalf of the provider, and these are the people that we are not going to trust. So this is the trust model today. If you go to a contemporary cloud platform, you have no option but to trust the cloud provider as well as the cloud administrator. And I'm going to talk about a threat model where the provider is trusted, but the administrator is not trusted. Okay? The administrator is capable of doing malicious things, and yet your cloud computing platform must protect client confidentiality and integrity. And later on, towards the end of the talk, I'll talk about this third point of the design space, where you can talk about both providers and administrators being untrusted, and it turns out to be an extremely challenging setting. The only solution known until a few years ago was an advanced form of cryptography called homomorphic encryption. But now it turns out that Intel has come up with a new processor called the SGX that is making some of these technologies possible. So I'll briefly allude to that towards the end of the talk, what these developments are and how they tie to self-service cloud computing. All right. So let me talk about self-service cloud computing, where providers are trusted and administrators are not trusted. Okay, so here's the remainder of this talk. I'm going to talk about the basic model that enables self-service cloud computing, what the basic principles are. I'll talk about some of the technical challenges. I'll give you a few protocols that solve this. I'll briefly present experimental evaluation. I just want to convey the ideas, so I'm going to leave pointers to the paper in case you're interested in reading detailed experimental evaluations. And finally, I'll compare our work with recent developments from Intel. All right. So let's look at the duties of the management VM. What is it capable of, and why is it so bloated, and what is it doing? So it turns out that you can broadly categorize the tasks of the management VM, DOM0, into two categories. So one is to manage and multiplex hardware resources. If you think about the machine that on which you're running your software, it's got a network card, it's got a sound card and whatnot, it's got display, and you need to manage these resources. This management is done using software called device drivers, and it turns out that on virtualized platforms, the management VM is running all of these device drivers. It's a huge body of code that's needed to manage all of this hardware. And in addition to this, you have also got all of these scripts that administrators use to manage client virtual machines. So what we are going to do in SSC, the self-service cloud platform, is that we're going to logically separate out these two functionalities. We're going to say that the task of managing the hardware must reside with the cloud provider. The cloud provider is never going to give that up because he wants control over the hardware, right? He controls the hardware, he wants to keep control of that. So we're going to factor out all of those functionalities into what is called a system-wide management virtual machine, or an SDOM0. I'm going to use the term SDOM0. And every client gets the ability to manage their own virtual machines. And this is going to be called UDOM0 or UserDOM0. And the system-wide management virtual machine, we are going to remove some privileges from it. The privileges to go and access each one of the client virtual machines and poke into their state. That's going to be removed from the system DOM0. So it's going to manage hardware, but it has absolutely no access to client virtual machines. Whereas the per client management virtual machines, they are just there to manage the client virtual machines, but they don't manage hardware or anything of that sort, and they allow clients to deploy their own services. So these two tricks together solve both of the problems that I alluded to earlier in this talk. The fact that clients want to control their own virtual machines, and they want to be in charge of the privacy and security of their virtual machines. And it turns out this is not just a random hack. You know, just separating these two things is not a random hack. These follow certain principles that were laid out in the mid-1970s for how computer security should be done right. And the principles that our system design follows are what are called the principle of separation of privilege, which means that there should be no one entity on the system that is concentrated with all of the privileges that are necessary for the system. You have disaggregated the privileges into two different principles in this case. And the second is the principle of least privilege, which states that each one of the entities that has the privilege must just have the correct amount of privileges in order to perform the task and no more. Okay? So it's our design is an embodiment of these two principles. Okay, so what does an SSC or the self-service cloud platform look like? We've got a special hypervisor with a modified privilege model, which I will get to shortly. But there is a single system-wide SDOM0 that's managing all of the hardware. And every client gets its own UDOM0 that's used to manage all of the work virtual machines, which it can sort of spawn. And if the UDOM0 wants to spawn off some special services, so for example, this work virtual machine wants to be monitored all of the time for security, it needs another virtual machine monitoring whether, you know, it's been infected or not, the UDOM0 can spawn off that as a separate malicious software detection service that then accesses this virtual machine state and checks whether it's running okay. Importantly, this service virtual machine that's doing all of the scanning is not under the control of the cloud provider, and so the cloud provider has absolutely no access to the state of the work virtual machine. Therefore, the client security and privacy are protected. And all of this together, we are going to call the client meta domain. All of these virtual machines together, they are a collection of virtual machines that are accomplishing the client's tasks for the client. And so we are going to call it a meta domain because it's a collection of virtual machines that's running on the cloud on behalf of the client. All right, and I'm going to introduce a security feature that is there on all modern motherboards. It's called a Trusted Platform Module Chip. This is a piece of hardware that you can easily obtain that is capable of doing the following. It's capable of providing you with what are called cryptographic attestations, which means that it can measure what's exactly running on your system. It can attest that you're running, let's say, Windows 10. It can attest that you're running certain applications, and it can prove to a remote party that your machine was started that way. Okay, so I won't get into the details of how this hardware platform works, but that's the high-level goal of this hardware platform. It's called the Trusted Platform Module. And it will become clear why we need this on the self-service cloud computing platform. The high-level idea is that you need this in order to prove to the client that its virtual machines were started correctly. Okay, so here's the privilege model on our modified hypervisor. All it's going to do is going to check whether there's a privileged operation. So a privileged operation is, for instance, an operation where one virtual machine is requesting to access the memory of another. This is not something that you should allow on a virtual machine platform because that breaks the isolation boundary that you would normally expect on a virtualized platform. But if this privileged operation is originating from the client's UDOM 0, then we are going to allow it, otherwise we are going to deny it. So this gives the client's UDOM 0 the privileges to manage its own virtual machines. This is going to be our privilege model for the SSE hypervisor. Anything that comes from the client's own domain is going to be allowed on the other virtual machines that belong to the same client. Okay, so I'm going to talk about a few challenges in implementing this privilege model. Okay, so the first is that providers want some control. So as I've presented it, this cloud platform, it takes power away from the cloud provider. The cloud provider can no longer peek into the memory of the client virtual machines, and it loses control over what's running within the client virtual machines. If I was to take this idea to a cloud provider today, they'll laugh me out, right? They want to know what's running on their cloud platform. They want the control. So I'm going to introduce a feature called the mutually trusted abstraction that allows the cloud provider to regain some control. So why does the cloud provider want control? For the following reason, right? Try renting a virtual machine on Amazon and try hosting some malicious software for other people to download on Amazon. They'll immediately shut you down, right? This is because no cloud provider wants to become notorious for hosting malicious software. They don't want their clients to host malicious software and become a hub where other people can go and download malicious software. So they want to enforce some sort of regulatory compliance. This is typically done using what are called service level agreements. Today when you go to the cloud, you sign a piece of paper and you agree not to host malicious software on the cloud provider's computers. And they want some way to be able to enforce this on the cloud. Okay, I'm going to tell you about challenges involved in building trustworthy domains. After all, you're sending your virtual machines to the cloud and the cloud administrator is untrusted. How do you know that the cloud administrator has not replaced your virtual machine image with a malicious virtual machine image and starting something that you have absolutely no idea, no control over? So I'm going to talk about an abstraction called the domain builder that helps with this purpose, and a secure bootstrap protocol that provides clients and end-to-end security so that they can reason about their computations running on the cloud. Okay, so let's talk about this first challenge, the fact that providers want some control, right? So I mentioned this already, the client implicitly says he doesn't want any data leaks or corruption, and the cloud provider says, don't use my cloud for bad activities. Okay, so what is this mutually trusted abstraction that solves this problem? Well, remember this picture where I showed you a UDOM 0 and a service virtual machine and two different work virtual machines? I'm going to introduce this notion of a mutual trusted abstraction, which is going to be the following. It's going to be a special virtual machine that's made possible because of this hypervisor that starts up in such a way that both the cloud provider and the client can make sure that it started up correctly, right? So nobody tampered up with the startup protocol what started up there and what's running over there was something that the cloud provider and the client agreed upon. And once it starts up, it's locked. Neither the cloud provider nor the client can modify its execution. And so this mutually trusted service virtual machine is then going to perform all of the cloud provider's activities that it wants to do. For example, it wants to check that the client is not running malicious software. It can run it while running within the client's domain itself. Okay, so it's running within the client's domain. It's checking that the client's virtual machines are not infected, that they are not malicious. At the same time, the cloud provider has absolutely no control over this. So it cannot use the mutually trusted service virtual machine to read the client, the data of the virtual machine and steal all of the data. It's running as a client virtual machine. And nobody can tamper with its execution. That's a guarantee that's provided by this hypervisor. Okay, so what other things can you do with it? It turns out it's a very useful abstraction in practice. And here is a problem that really exists today, which is that of trustworthy metering. When you go to the cloud and ask for certain amount of computation time, you get billed by the hour, by the number of CPU cycles that you consume, by the number of bytes that you transferred over the network, and so on. And so you want the metering software that's measuring how many CPU cycles you consumed or how many bytes you transferred over the network to be reliable. Okay, so today resource accounting, this metering, is done entirely by the cloud provider. If the cloud provider sends you a bill at the end of the month saying, this is what you owe me, you have to pay the cloud provider. Now, how do you know the cloud provider is not cheating? Right? Supposing the cloud provider decides to add a few CPU cycles at the end of every week so as to inflate the bill, what do? You have to pay up. So if the result, one thing that you can do as a client is you can cross-check what the cloud provider is doing, right? you can try to make sure that the results that the cloud provider is reporting are consistent with what you would run with your own accounting software. But if the results are inconsistent, what do? Right? Who is correct? If you go and approach a conflict resolver such as a judge, who would they believe? Right? They have absolutely no way of providing proof that the metering software was running incorrectly. So with a mutually trusted service abstraction, you have hope of bringing some control over this process. So the way you would do this is that both the client and the cloud provider would agree upon what software is going to do metering. Now, once the client and the cloud provider have agreed upon this, nobody can contest that the software is wrong because they both checked it and it's doing metering. They agreed that it's going to be used to do resource accounting. And they started up as a mutually trusted service virtual machine, and now we have the guarantee that nobody can tamper with its execution. So it runs, and whatever output it provides, by definition, by the mutual trust definition, both the cloud provider and the client have to trust. Okay? So it's an incredibly useful abstraction in practice. All right. So let me tell you about how clients start virtual machines on this SSE hypervisor. Well, let's look at how you would start a virtual machine today on the cloud. You would go and give your virtual machine image to the DOM 0, this management virtual machine, which then starts it on the computing node. The problem in our setting is that this SDOM 0 is untrusted. We cannot expect it to start our virtual machines correctly. So what do? We introduce a new abstraction called the domain builder, which we trust. It's part of our trusted computing base. And we entrust it with the sole responsibility of creating new virtual machines. So the client gives all of its virtual machine images to the domain builder, whose sole responsibility is to start new client metadomains. So it starts off by building the UDOM 0, which then spawns further virtual machines. Of course, all communication is controlled by SDOM 0 because it's controlling, for instance, the networking card. So all communication goes through the domain builder. So we still need some guarantee that the untrusted cloud administrator has not tampered with the virtual machine image that we are sending to the DOM builder. How do we accomplish that? Right? So in order to do that, you need an encrypted communication channel with the domain builder that the cloud provider cannot tamper with, right? So if you have an end-to-end encrypted connection from the client to the domain builder, then you're secure, okay? But this is a very tricky thing to establish, and let me tell you why. So in order to build a domain, in order to build a virtual machine and establish an SSL channel with a client, you have to somehow, and SSL refers to the secure sockets layer, right? This is what you use every time you use HTTPS. Every time you open a bank website, this is what opens up on your browser. This is the protocol that runs on your browser, secure sockets layer. So you need to establish this end-to-end connection with your virtual machine that's running on the cloud. How do you do this when SDOM0 controls the network, okay? The main problem that arises is something called the evil twin attack. And let me describe that attack next, which will motivate the design of the protocol that we actually use. All right, so what's an evil twin attack? Let's say you have a particular virtual machine image that in mind to start on the cloud, a certain UDOM0 image. It's a virtual machine disk image that you're going to give to SDOM0. Now what SDOM0 does is that it pretends to accept it, but then it passes its own virtual machine image to the domain builder, which then builds the domain on behalf of the client. So now that is running on behalf of the client, but it's a potentially compromised virtual machine. And if the client installs any secret cryptographic keys within UDOM0, the cloud provider may have installed scripts that steal these keys, and that's the end of that. Because once you have stolen cryptographic keys, then all future secure communication that are based on those keys are then visible to the cloud administrator. He can then go and decrypt all of that communication. So this is no good. We want to avoid the evil twin attack. And so how do we go about accomplishing this? Well, so we leverage the trusted platform module. A little bit of hardware often goes a long way in helping computer security. And so we're going to use this trusted platform module in order to provide guarantees that the domain, that the UDOM0 or any other client virtual machine that we started was started up correctly in a reliable fashion without tampering by the cloud administrator. Okay, so here's what we are going to do. Okay, so when we send our UDOM0 image to the cloud to start our virtual machines, we are not just going to send the UDOM0 over to the domain builder, rather we are going to send that stuff shown in Maru. Right? So what is that? So it's a piece of ciphertext that contains an encryption of a random key generated by the client together with a random nonce, which I'm going to depict using this coin. It's a random number that's generated by the client, a one-time random number generated by the client, and the whole thing is encrypted using the TPM's public key, which the client is assumed to know, right? It's a piece of hardware that's equipped with a public and a private key. The public key is known to everybody and the private key is burned into hardware. It's capable of doing encryption and decryption using this public and private key. Simple RSA type encryption that, you know, our browsers do every time we use HTTPS. So this is what the client sends over to the domain builder. What the domain builder does is that it builds the domain using this virtual machine image that was given to it by the client. This is where the evil twin attack happened. The cloud provider or the cloud administrator, if he was malicious, could have supplied a UDOM0 image that was different from what the client initially gave to build on the cloud. All right, so how do we prevent that? Well, the domain builder builds the domain, it decrypts these keys and the random number, and it installs them within the DOM0 by decrypting using the TPM. And then it provides a measurement. So it goes and computes a hash of all of the code pages of this virtual machine that we just started, signs it using the TPM, and gives it back to the client. Okay. So with that signed hash, it's a digitally signed hash of the virtual machine that was just started, the client now has an assurance that the UDOM0 was started correctly. If the UDOM0 or this virtual machine image was tampered with by the untrusted cloud administrator, the hashes won't match, and the cloud and the client will immediately realize that an attack was underway, and he can stop spawning further virtual machines on the cloud. But if the hashes are correct, he gets the assurance that the UDOM0 was started correctly without an evil twin attack. All right, so now we have at this point a UDOM0 with a key that was generated by the client. It's important to know that this key is within the UDOM0, this domain to which the cloud administrator who's controlling SDOM0 has absolutely no access to. So he cannot read the contents of the key as well as this random number. All right, so the random number is sent to the client to ensure freshness, to ensure that, you know, this is not a replay of an old value. And at this point, what the client sends to the domain is an encrypted is a piece of ciphertext that contains his SSL private key encrypted using that key. Now once it comes to this domain, it can decrypt this, it's got the SSL private key, and everything is just as it was when you're starting your browsing, secure browsing session with your bank, right? Your bank and your browser are going to engage in HTTPS. It's exactly that setting. And that setting is called the SSL handshake. Now you can sort of implement the SSL handshake on top of this, and you would have an end-to-end encrypted connection with the client, who can then send other domains with. Now the guarantee is that encryption is going to protect the confidentiality and integrity of these virtual machine images, and it's now going to be built by the UDOM0 on this system without interference from SDOM0. So that is how we start domains. There's absolutely no interference now at this point from SDOM0 because cryptography provides you the power to protect the confidentiality and integrity of your virtual machine images. All right. So this is what it all looks like, just a picture that contains the aggregation of all of these things. You have the SSC hypervisor, which I told you about with the special privilege model. You've got mutually trusted service virtual machines. These service virtual machines, which I'm going to describe a few examples of, malicious software detection. You can have firewalls and intrusion detection systems running as services. You can have storage services, for example, encrypted storage, encrypted checkpointing. And all of these service the work of the actual computation that runs on the cloud. Okay, so let me just give you a couple of examples, right? We have implemented a whole host of services as these service VMs, things like encryption, intrusion detection, you can do checkpointing, memory deduplication, you can implement network firewalls. We have around 10 or 15 such services that we have implemented. I'm going to show you two examples together with some numbers to get a feel of what the overheads are, you know, how slow is it, and so on. And this is the setup on which we implemented all of this. It's a fairly powerful server. And as I said, I'm not going to focus too much on the experimental results. I'm going to leave you pointers for where you can find all of the details. But let me show you what the ballpark numbers look like. All right, so I'm going to describe a storage encryption service that's built on top of this SSC platform, where the idea is that when the client's storage, right, he's got persistent storage on the cloud, when the client sends all of his data to the persistent storage disk on the cloud, he wants it to be encrypted. Okay, so he wants it to be encrypted to protect it from the cloud administrator. The cloud administrator is going to poke the disk, he can read all of the contents, but if it's encrypted, he cannot read the clear text contents of this data. So this is how storage works on a traditional virtualized platform. The client's work virtual machine, which contains all of the data which needs to be committed to disk, communicates with the disk driver that sits on this SDOM0, which then writes everything down to disk. This is how typical virtualization works. So what we are going to do is that we are going to interpose on this communication using a service virtual machine, which is running with the client's privileges. And what we are going to do is that we are going to interpose and encrypt everything before it ever hits SDOM0. So all that SDOM0 would ever see is encrypted communication. So it never sees the client data in the clear. All right, and this is what the numbers look like on our setup, right? If you're just going to send data encrypted, then, you know, on a traditional platform that does not use our privilege model, you have a fairly high throughput of around a throughput of around 81.72 megabytes per second. And if you use our platform, it's a very small overhead, and you get a hit of around 6 megabytes per second in order to store data. And this was a standard workload. I think we tried to encrypt the entire Linux kernel and store it on disk. And so that's for unencrypted, sorry. If you were to just send it without encryption, right? So this served as a simple pipe that did not do any encryption. If you did encryption, then, you know, even on a traditional system, you would have some overhead. So you see the throughput drop from 81 to around 71.9 megabytes per second. And with self-service, it's around 70.64. So, you know, in some sense, the overhead is slightly lesser in this case because you're doing heavyweight computations even on a traditional platform. All right. So one of the nice things about these service virtual machines is you can chain services. You can say, look, I want to compose the functionality of checkpointing together with encryption so that I can produce encrypted checkpoints. So here is an example of that, right? So if you want to, let's say, checkpoint your virtual machine so that you can restore from the checkpoint, that is possible on today's cloud computing platforms. But let's say you want to store an encrypted checkpoint, because checkpoints are nothing but pages of code and data. which if you store in the clear, the cloud provider can go and use it to compromise the secrecy and integrity of your virtual machines. So you want to encrypt it and then store it. It's very simple in this case. All you do is you chain these services as I showed in the previous slide. The service goes from the client's virtual machine into something that's going to perform checkpointing, which is then going to go to something that performs encryption, which is then going to go to SDOM 0, which writes it out to disk. Okay? So it's very simple in our framework to perform such chaining of services. And here are sort of the overheads of doing such chaining. If you're going to simply do checkpointing without encryption, it takes around 1.8 seconds to sort of checkpoint the entire Linux kernel. And if you were to encrypt it and then, if you want to checkpoint it and then encrypt it, it takes slightly longer. But the overheads you can see, this is a traditional platform and this is our enhanced platform with the additional security guarantees. And it's a slightly higher overhead in terms of the time taken to perform these services. All right, so that sort of concludes my discussion of self-service cloud computing. So let me now tell you about this exciting new development from Intel that promises to change the face of cloud computing security. Okay, and as I mentioned in my threat model slide, we work with this threat model where the cloud provider is trusted and the administrator is not trusted. And what this new hardware gives us is the ability to work even if the provider and administrator are untrusted. Now, if you think about this for a second, it's an extremely challenging setting, right? You're saying, I want to take my code and data to a platform that's not controlled by me, it's controlled by an adversary, and yet I want secrecy and integrity for all of my computations that's running on this adversarially controlled platform. It's an extremely challenging setting. All right. So, and this is made possible using this new development called Intel Software Guard Extensions, or SGX. So what is it, right? And it's there on the latest motherboard called Skylark, and it's going to become, I think, even more popular going into the future. So what it does is that it provides hardware support for what are called in-process enclaves. So an enclave is nothing but a safe region within a process. A process is, as you would, you know, a traditional process on an operating system, it's a safe region within the process where you can store code and data, and you have the assurance, the hardware provides you the assurance that neither the process nor the operating system can go and read the contents of the enclave. So how does it provide this? Well, basically hardware encrypts all of the pages that have been marked as enclave pages, and the hardware is going to ensure that any attempt to access data in the enclave in the clear can only happen if control resides within the enclave. If control is within the process or within the operating system and each one of these entities is trying to poke into the enclave, access is going to be denied by the hardware. Okay? So that's how this platform provides security even in this adversarial setting. So you would think, you know, you have got this setting where this enclave is providing you these really strong guarantees. Why would you even use this self-service cloud computing platform abstraction? Why would you even need all of these things, SDOM 0, UDOM 0, when the enclave can accomplish all of these tasks for you? And the answer is that there have been a number of developments, recent developments that are building on top of the SGX to provide this cloud, this security for clients. Okay, so this brings us to the question, why would you think about SSE in the world of Intel SGX? So the answer is that the SGX has completely flipped the threat model. So today, cloud providers have complete control of everything that's running on their cloud platforms. This is good from their perspective. Of course, it's bad from the client's perspective. What the SGX does, or the SGX promises to do, is that now the clients are in complete control of everything that's running on the cloud provider's platform, and the cloud provider has lost control, right? Now, if the client runs malicious software or uses these enclaves to host malicious software on the cloud, the cloud provider has absolutely no idea what's going on, and it has absolutely no control. And so, you know, as we spoke about this mutual trust abstraction, cloud providers may not be willing to give so much control to clients. And so these mutual trust ideas that I spoke about still have some relevance in the world of the SGX. And, you know, it makes sense to think about this mutually trusted abstraction between the cloud provider and the client that can still monitor what's going on within the enclave without, you know, giving away the client's privacy, without revealing what's going on within the enclave to the cloud provider. So these are things that I am thinking about, my students are thinking about as we, you know, rethink the ideas of SSC in the face of the Intel SGX. All right. So there are a number of other related projects too that inspired our work. I'm just sort of showing you these related work. So there was an idea called the CloudVisor, which was nothing but SGX and software. There were other ideas to implement these per client DOM domain zeros or management virtual machines, and we sort of used these to synthesize our ideas. This is all prior work that inspired self-service cloud computing. All right. So with that, let me conclude by saying that we think that SSC is a cloud model that attempts to improve the security and privacy of client code and data in a world where administrators aren't trusted but the provider is trusted. It enhances client control over their virtual machines, and it enables a notion of mutual trust, which we think is valuable moving forward even in the world of the SGX. All right, so here's a pointer to some of the other kinds of projects that I do. The broad theme of the work that I do is computer system security, and I work on things like OS security, hardware support for security, web applications, and retrofitting legacy code, and so on. And I must thank my collaborators and students, without which none of this would have been possible, especially my students who did all of the hard work, and I get to talk about it over here. That's it. Thank you very much for hosting me and for inviting me to give this talk. Thank you. I can take any questions. Yes, there is a dependence on the trusted platform module. That's correct.
Is it becoming a single point of
failure? It could, right? I mean, we are relying on it. So in some sense, it's providing the cryptographic support and the root of trust that's upon which we are building. I don't think I would characterize it as a single point of failure, because it's now there. It's on commodity motherboards these days. And it's just doing cryptography for us. So it's a necessary link. I wouldn't characterize it as a single point of failure.
Thank you.
Thank you very much. Thank you very much. This is what I also got from string theory, and I am appreciative of it.
I'm not sure I put my banking details on Google today, but anyway, I'll wait for your software. Are you here today?
I'm here today.
But okay, some of like Amazon, they have started providing some.